Hey everybody, we're back with another movie. It's not a first-run movie, it's not a last-run movie. It's last year's 2019 surprise Oscar winner, Parasite, directed and written by one Bong Joon-ho, which you might recognize as the director and writer of The Host, Mother, Seafog, Okja, perhaps Snowpiercer might be a title that a lot of Western audiences are familiar with. He wrote this film, he directed it, he won some Oscars. Jim, I knew nothing about this movie other than I thought it was a Korean horror film when I was going in to watch this movie. Cecily wanted to watch it because she's become a Bong Joon-ho disciple recently. And I was completely blown away. I staggered out of that movie theater like, the hell did I just watch? Did you have any expectations? What was your first watch like, et cetera, et cetera?
I thought this was going to be Korean Knives Out. And so I was like surprised at what I actually ended up getting, because I don't think there are actually all that many similarities other than a rich family and poor servants being in the film. Other than that, I don't think there's a lot to compare here.
Really?
But I ended up really enjoying the movie.
You don't think, because like I can't remember if that's the recommendation I made to you when we first started talking about it, or
everybody,
if it's something.
Everybody was making that.
Because it does seem like they're both essentially black comedies, at least a large part of the structure. They're also they're explicitly a critique of, you know, social stratification and the haves versus the have-nots and the attitudes that are kind of between there, crossing personal lines, crossing professional lines. But you didn't think that the comparison is all that apt?
No, I think they're pretty different.
How so?
This movie actually has a lot more to say about that than Knives Out, I think. Knives Out is more of a fun sort of romp through that landscape, class landscape. And then it turns out like the ending is actually pretty happy. This, the ending of this movie to me is very, very dark. Very hopeless and sad.
Yeah. If you want to kind of preserve your surprise and like initial impressions, you might want to bail out now because I think we've said all that we want to say non-spoilery. If you're not familiar, the premise of this film is you have a poor Korean family, the Kims, and they're shown as really down on their luck. They're kind of down to their last won, the Korean currency. They're getting all their services canceled. They might be threatening to be evicted. And then one of them has a college friend who provides them a hookup to tutoring services of the rich Park family, who lives high above, almost in the clouds, above the Kim station. And the Kims come up with a scheme to slowly replace the household staff of the Parks with their own family, an elaborate chain of referrals that will eventually have every member of the family working for the Parks. And chaos, hilarity, tragedy, everything ensues. So now that we've got that synopsis over it, let's just talk about this film. Okay, this is a complicated film. Where to begin? There's clearly a lot of commentary to be had about the film's plot and themes. I want to talk about the artistic. It's always hard for me to judge some of this stuff when I'm looking at a foreign film because, you know, I become aware as I watch more of this stuff, like the way people's inflections work, like the way people's like voice intonations and things like that stuff gets lost in translation. Like I know what I can tell the difference when I'm looking at an English speaking person, between like if they're stressed, if they're angry, if they're like at the end of their rope, if they're doing that ironically. You know, I have a lot of nuance in that where some of the foreign films, like I have a harder grasp on that, and you have to split your time between looking at the performances and looking at the subtitles. But one thing I found almost universal is like a well-composited shot just kind of pops off of the screen, and like a really good music cue that heightens the sensibility of the scene really works out well. And I find that like Mr. Bong here is an amazing shot composition guy. Like, every frame of painting, there's many, many, many frames and many, many paintings in this film. And it starts off like the way he shoots the Kim's apartment and how claustrophobic and almost like it's something out of a Wes Anderson film. This ramshackle collection of apartments, them hunching behind a toilet to get Wi-Fi signal. And then you go to the big airy kind of expanded vistas of the Kims. I just thought it was all really gorgeous.
Yeah, I'm with you. I haven't seen a lot of Korean cinema, so I don't know how this kind of stacks up against the typical Korean movie. But yeah, I found myself over the course of this film sort of looking at it and going, man, that is a crisp shot. There's mm-hmm. something like, it's not sterile. There's like a lot of life to it, but also there's something just like, I don't know, visually crisp to the whole thing, where it maybe it's imagery that I'm not used to seeing, and so it sort of stands out.
Yeah,
things like that.
I know what you mean. It's like the way I was thinking about it in terms of like everything about the Kim's existence below the kind of like poverty line feels like A New Hope, Star Wars. It's, you know, the R2-D2's okay. got a ding on his head. The X-Wings are dirty. There's dust in a thing. Where if when you move into the park side, everything is very The Phantom Menace. Shiny, chrome, you know, well-maintained, immaculately landscaped. They're living in a, you know, they're supposed to be living in a building of a famous Korean architect, and it looks like that.
But they somehow get to that feeling without using like color filters or any of the typical tricks that I'm used to. They're somehow are able to divide, like demarcate between the rich and the poor life, and maybe it just comes down to being you know, the verticality of it, you know, being underground versus being out in this open garden.
Well, and they also sell, there's a very couple points in the film, most notably in the beginning of the third act, where the Kims are in disgrace heading back to their flooded hovel. And just the sheer amount of vertical space that they, like, there's this long cement staircase that they have to walk down, and they just, it just keeps going on and on, like all the gutters they have to go through. Like, it just really sells how far they are. You know, how far they've sailed above their station in life and how much further the Kims are, or the parks are above them. I just think that's amazing. And also, like, the minimal use of like sound in the soundtrack, I think, was really good. There's a couple moments where there's like some cues when things shocking happen, to build suspense. But like, it's a very minimalist soundscape, I would say. And you know, it kind of suits the films, like you said, minimal. Like, everything, the camera feels a lot of times locked down. And the shots are like pre-composited. And I thought, I don't know, it's like you said, it's not sterile, but it is pristine, especially when they're dealing with the Kims. The film is also, like, especially the first half, objectively hilarious.
Oh God, there are so many scenes in this where I was cracking up.
Like the go ahead. I'm sorry.
Early on, the one where they're, you know, they have this constant menace throughout the movie, where there are people pissing in the alley, right? Just drunk people, homeless people, whatever, out there pissing in the alley. And when they have the fight between the deluge in slow motion as she's recording on the phone, it's so good. It's so funny.
I thought the dad was really funny too. Like, when they're like, one of the jobs they're settling for is folding pizza boxes. And they see like a fumigator coming down. They're like, close the window so the fumes. And he's like, no, leave them open. Free fumigation. And they're sitting there folding these pizza boxes. It's a horror show, because already these things are seem like unsanitary. No one's wearing gloves. They're sitting on the floor. They're folding these pizza boxes. And now the residence is being flooded with these toxic yellow fumes. And his dad, the dad's just got the eye of the tiger, though. He's just watching that YouTube video on how to fold these damn boxes. It's just really funny, and like how like cutthroat they are. Like, I really enjoyed the daughter, how well they establish her as like the real con artist of the family. And she understands that, like, you know, where the other ones are might like cringe, and they're the way she needs to play this role is very imperious, right? Hey, I'm a graduate of a big swinging dick American art school. And it seems like American culture and education has put a premium in this film. And, you know, like, I'm going, instead of like charging what I think would be a fair rate, I'm going to try to imagine what like a rich people rate for a highly coveted person. And I'm going to not let, I'm not like my brother, I'm not going to let this woman sit in the room and watch me instruct. I'm going to tell her, nah, that's not how I teach. Get the hell out of here. And how that works so well. Just her being like imperious and how easy it is to fool these, I guess, these wealthy people once you get within their so-called belt of trust. The family remarks several times, like just how like, you know, easy it is to fool these people and flatter them and play the role.
And that's where some of the comedy comes into, you know, some of these schemes that they cook up to, you know, the panty scheme in particular, I thought was pretty funny, but there's just a lot more comedy that I really loved. Like the scene where, I guess the main character of the story, the son of the Kim family, goes in and he's, you know, pretending to be this tutor, this English tutor for the daughter. Mm-hmm. And he's looking at this painting that the youngest, Dasong, or I think his name is, the youngest Park kid.
Yeah, the one's crazy done. About
And he's
the...
looking at it, he's like, it's a chimpanzee, right?
Uh-huh.
And she says, a self-portrait. And he takes this long pause
while
he's looking at the thing and he's then says, sure enough.
Yeah. Like he's,
it's,
you know,
just so good.
But I thought that there's also like a lot of funny stuff. Like, you know, there's the whole basement family plot. And when that kind of blows up in the Kim's face, and they're taken hostage and the former housekeeper is doing these like grandiose proclamations about how they're going to bring the family. Then she's doing it in the style of like a North Korean news anchor. And I've thought about like,
and he's like, you're the best at impersonating North Korean news anchors.
Yeah, like, imagine that, like, I was just thinking, like, how crazy that must be to, like, imagine if you live in Detroit and, like, right across the Canadian border in, like, Winnipeg or something, they're just talking mad shit about America all the time on how they're imminently going to destroy the capitalist pigs and blah, blah, blah. Like, and you can just, you don't have to, like, look it up on YouTube. It's literally being broadcast. Like, there's radio stations and TV stations. Like, I never thought about how absurd and funny that might be to South Koreans to be able to hear these delusional, you know, radio stations from their less fortunate neighbors to the north. But I thought that stuff was really funny, too. And one of the few moments of like comedy left in the film, because it gets pretty bleak and grim after that. And then I also think there's some interesting, like, so this film establishes this concept of crossing the line, which means something very different from the Kims and the Parks. And you gradually appreciate that as the if you got a car driver and he's picking up girls and fucking girls in your Mercedes Benz, it's pretty obvious crossing of a line. If the help gets overly familiar and, you know, overly involved in your affairs, that crosses the line, too. But what's brilliant is because of the stage that he set and the way he's chosen to film this stuff, there's all these vertical and horizontal literal lines. Like in this architect's house, there's this nearly transparent seam in the windows. That the first time we meet the lady of the Park House, the mother, the wife of the famous Korean industrialist, she is passed out at a patio table, and the housekeeper comes and it's kind of like you can see her like, Jesus, how am I going to handle this? And they frame it to where that seam is dividing them perfectly down the middle of the table. She's on one side of the line, the householder's on the other, and she like springs across it to like clap in the woman's face to kind of wake her out of her drunken stupor, and then immediately retreats over the line so that the housekeeper doesn't see, you know, that she clapped in her face to get her attention. But I was thinking as I saw this, and like I was made aware of this stuff on film Twitter, like right after the movie came out, and we saw it, I think, opening weekend. They were like, look at all these line crosses. Like there's all this vertical layers of bamboo people crossing. There's the horizon line. There's the lines in the yard. There's the lines in like people literally hiding beneath tables and stuff.
They use the gutter as a line at one point.
Yeah, of something that's going to have to be crossed. And like the second time watching this movie, it's crazy if you look at how many metaphorical and literal lines that are crossed. But the first time I got like all the lines that the Kim family is crossing. But the second time I watched it, I got a lot of like lines that the Park family is crossing to the Kims. Like the fact that on their weekend off, this rich family just thinks they can put together this party and come quickly. We need you to bring and pick up all this stuff. And like, they don't consider that as crossing a line. Mm-hmm. But you know, if Mr. Kim asked Mr. Park for a pay advance, hey, you know, my wife needs an operation. I need it. Like, he would see that undoubtedly as a line crossing.
Yeah, it's all about, you know, and they tell them when they asked him to cross these lines, when they asked the Kims to do it, that, you know, consider this part of your work. You know, we're paying you, we want what we want, and the money will make the inappropriateness of it go away.
Right, but they also want to have, like, you know, these people as, like, trusted friends and confidants, that you can trust your child to sit on mm-hmm. their lap and paint for hours at a time, unsupervised, and... the dual meaning of this film, Parasite, is interesting because, I mean, I'll see what you think about it. I think it's got an obvious interpretation and then a second thought interpretation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the obvious one is that the Kim family is a parasite on the Park family, right?
Right, right.
The less obvious one, I think, is just flipping those things around, where the Park family is actually a parasite on the society as a whole, mm-hmm. on the people, I guess the, like, poorer people of the Korean society.
Yeah.
It's how I would view it anyway.
But also, I think it's not, like, totally one-sided, because we find that Mr. Park is kind of like a, you know, he is an industrialist. He is built, probably creating a lot of technology and jobs for people, and he's generating a lot of wealth for that country. So, like, it's so interesting because following people writing about this is interesting to see... like I read a lot of interesting think pieces from critics who clearly got this internal dichotomy that, like, the Kims are the obvious parasites feeding off the rich, wealthy, you know, vice versa. But there was a couple, like, upper middle class and higher critics and, like, people on Twitter that were clearly horrified at the idea that the Kims would be seen as, like, protagonists in this film. Like, it shakes them to their core, the idea that their housekeeper, their gardener,
really
might be doing this shit. And I guess, like, in a very Fight Club kind of way, mm-hmm. we're the people who take out your trash and watch your children and clean your clothes. It is terrifying to fact that the people that you trust in your home to do this intimate labor might actually hate you and look to take advantage of you.
It should be terrifying, right?
Yeah.
Right? That's the whole point. It should be terrifying. Like, yeah. You can't treat people poorly and then expect to not be terrified of the retribution of that poor treatment. Like,
yeah.
That's how it goes.
Yeah,
like that's the price you pay. You know, they pay the price of not being able to live a decent life, having to scrounge by and hoping that, you know, the next catastrophe won't just do away with them.
Yeah.
And you have to live with the horror that maybe they're fucking somebody in your Mercedes-Benz.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And there's also some interesting things about, like, how quickly the Kims get, like, I want to say entitled, more like comfortable with the crossing of the lines. Like, yeah, the first couple times it's like, oh gosh, are we committing fraud? Are we doing, or it's like, oh, well, I guess this is, like, everybody tries to get ahead, to, like, by the end, they're full blown sabotaging. They are, harming people's health. They are killing people to maintain these advantages. And it shows how cutthroat the competition is between this, you know, servant class, how quickly they're willing to throw each other under the bus to get ahead. There's a couple of scenes where I was watching a second time and I, like, gasp at, like, things like where Mr. Kim grabs Mrs. Kim's ass. And, like, you know, if Mr. Park turns around and sees that, then, like, the jig's up. But they're just like, and then they throw the Parks go away camping, and they throw the best act in the whole movie is launched when the Parks go away on camping. And the first time I remember, like, all this tension didn't exist. It's like, oh, this is a fun scene. The Kims are now drinking and are having a good time. But I didn't notice it's raining. It's pouring down rain. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they break a dish or they break a glass or they and I'm like, they make a mess. I'm like, oh, I wonder if they're going to come home early. Then they introduce the basement family and they keep on. Man, this is such a stressful second watch because I know what's coming. And it's like, how are they going to get out of this situation? But, like, that just kept on at. And that's where I was trying to get to with this, like, the comfort level, is that there's this scene where the Kims were kind of enjoying the quote unquote good life. But they were kind of quickly realizing, I don't know if we like this. Like, we're just sitting around and we're drinking and we're starting to talk shit about each other. And like, what is there to do if you're in this? Like, is it, did you get any of that too? Or am I reading too much into it?
I might have gotten a little of that. And I think it's also sort of reflected in the mother of the park family, right? Because she doesn't necessarily do anything, right? She's got a housekeeper who cooks all the meals and does all the laundry and cleans everything. And even the park husband is kind of like, oh yeah, she doesn't do anything, you know?
Right.
Like, and he doesn't even, like, it doesn't even seem like he's clearly in love with her. There's a scene where he's talking with Mr. Kim in the car, and it makes it seem like he's just tolerating her presence, which is a little weird.
Yeah, that
but
they
married. She seems almost kind of useless as much as the Park or the Kim family starts to feel underwhelmed with the scope of life in a house like that.
And you see that, like, you know, that causes her to, like, make mountains out of molehills. Like, you know, she's got a son and she needs to believe that he's a genius artist, because else that's something she can do. She can nurture an artist. Mm. But, you know, the first time we see her, she's collapsed in some kind of alcoholic stupor.
Yeah.
She's clearly unfulfilled in this world. Like, you know, is she a parasite on her husband? Are their kids parasites? Like, and they also do a lot of other interesting juxtapositions too. Like, it's very jarring for me in 2020 to see people walking around in, like, full, you know, chief, tribal elder chief headdresses, because it's been beaten into our head in at least our generation that that's, like, wildly offensive. Like, you're taking sacred cultural and religious artifacts. That's essentially like a rock star parading around drunkenly in, like, Pope robes or something. Like, that's and to see the Parks doing that, because their son is really into camping and he really fell in love with the concept of Native Americans, and they have this, like, completely facile appreciation for it. Like, they've got this really fake synthetic tint that they're saying, oh, it's pretty good because it comes from America and that's where Native Americans come from, so this is authentic. I thought that was interesting too, that you know, when you get some of these racial kind of justice things and you get it outside the original culture and see what other countries are doing or feeling about it, it also makes me reflect on, you know, our own plight. Like, what are we missing when we look at the world and we look at different things, like, you know, like what injustices are we blind to? What things are we being blithe about?
I felt that watching this movie. Like, I there's a lot I don't understand about Korean cinema, and
right,
there's a lot in this movie, I think, that I just don't get, like symbolism. Like, so I read a little bit of an article where Bong Joon-ho was talking about the rock, the scholar rock in this film, and what that meant. And I was gratified to see that I had maybe picked up on the hints he was dropping, where this is sort of like he's carrying around his hope sort of in this rock for a better future for his family. And so I was picking up on that, but I'm sure there's stuff around, like, the smell of these people, which they continually go on and on. I mean, I think it's just a class divide kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, poor people have a smell to them, right? Because they're not living in these pristine environments. It's like,
yeah, they're living in this moldy basement.
Yeah, if you work at McDonald's, guess what? You smell like Big Macs 95% of the time. And that shit takes a while to wear off, right? Like, everybody in your house is going to smell like it. That's just how it is. Whereas they're living in the pristine upper echelons of society, where those smells don't even enter into their daily routines.
No, they never put on the same piece of clothes. They're all sleeping in matching pristine silk pajamas with matching kangaroo leather slippers or whatever the hell they are. Yeah, the fact that they would smell moldy or have any kind of smell would be something that they can't even conceive of. And that's the other thing, is like how they don't, there is truly no understanding of how each other lives. Like, when the Kims get up to the Parks and they see how, like, they're like jaw dropped at, like, when the son goes up there, the older son that's posing as the tutor, he's just like jaw drops as he keeps walking up to this place and seeing, like, the yard they have and, like, how much light and space and freedom. And then you can tell by the way the parks act, they have no idea what it'd be like to live in like a half basement that every time monsoon season comes around, you got to worry that it's going to flood.
Yeah.
Which I did a little bit of research too. And apparently that's like, you know, those are like the typical lower class urban dwellings that people take. And that is a problem that during monsoon season, they do tend to flood. And there is a lot of mildew and mold things that are just, you know, essentially a constant there.
God, so speaking of the rain, when it rains and pours, that was one hell of a night. Like, they get stuck in the park house, you know, creeping around, trying not to get caught. And then when they get out, they get home and their home has flooded with sewage.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it's hilarious, like, with this toilet spewing sewage into the air and, like, you know, them puking in toilets and, like, all this stuff is funny, but at the same time it's so tragic.
Yeah, and they tie it together karmically. Like, so this is at the end of this long night where we find out there's this basement dwelling family, there's this complex backstory where this woman has tried to stay the housekeeper of this house because she's hiding her husband, who is down on his luck and is hiding from, I think, debt creditors, in this panic room that the parks don't know about. And that breaks bad because they try, you know, obviously the Kims have used dirty underhanded tactics, get them all jobs there. And she's got proof of it. And there's this whole hostage scene where she has video of them essentially that she's holding hostage. But there's a scuffle. She gets hurt very badly. She takes a bad blow to the head and she's dying. She's dying of a concussion. She's throwing up. And as she's throwing up in the toilet, all the sewage is erupting on across town out of the Kim's toilet. Yeah. And I felt like that was like a direct karma connection the film was making. The actions that the Kims had trying to get ahead was now biting them in the ass. And they were trying to appear as this kind of genteel middle class, you know, professional butler type, you know, driver, you know, grade. Mm-hmm. Servant class, and it was all being exploded in their face. All the lies, all the betrayals, all the people thrown under buses was coming back, and I thought that was a really great way to illustrate that.
Yeah, and as they've sort of taken over the park house, their own house has been destroyed, right?
Mm-hmm.
I feel that's pretty interesting.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Also, I look at the basement as it relates to like the Park family and the Kim family. We see the servant class in this movie living in basements exclusively. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. they're down in a semi basement for their home. The older housekeeper has her husband living down there in the basement, and the Parks don't even see the basement. They mm-hmm. don't even know the basement exists, let right. alone know that there are people who are suffering down in those basements, people who yeah. might not be as fortunate as they are. They don't even know they fucking exist. They don't yeah. think about them.
And the way that the basement is portrayed is like this black hole that people just disappear into. And then yeah. they also, there's this overhead shot when the Parks are sleeping on the couch above the Kims, and the Kims are hiding under coffee table. The coffee table design looks like a downward spiral with a inky black hole in the middle of it. And I thought that that was still tying that visual metaphor that, like, you're right that these people, this is sight unseen. Like, the Parks, if they knew about some of these things, might feel guilty, but they've arranged their life to where they never have to be confronted with the fact that they are living in this luxury at the expense of these other people. Because, you know, that's the other thing. Did you do any research into, like, some of the motivations for why Junho made this film?
I know he started writing it immediately after Snowpiercer, but that's about it.
Yeah, that, like, there's this concept of, like, something that I've seen in the Western world too, in the last word, this concept of hell world. Like, hell world is briefly the juxtaposition for living in this presumably wealthy, powerful country that also has, like, third world problems, like children starving and whatnot. Like, hell world is a rich pharmaceutical company charging $1,000 for a month's supply of insulin, and it's a blue-collar family being arrested and their supplies of hand sanitizer confiscated because they're trying to take advantage of someone's medical need. You know, Hell World is a child that is selling his Xbox, and this article being passed around as an inspirational story to save his brother so he can pay for part of a kidney transplant instead of having a functional healthcare system. Korea has their own version of this. They call it Hell Joseon. And I guess Joseon, and I'm probably butchering the pronunciation, is an old way to refer to Korea and the Korean peninsula. And it's something that I guess it's exclusively now, it's seen as like a fuddy-duddy term, except for North Korea. Exclusive refers to itself as that, and I guess expatriates outside of Korea. So this idea that, like, we're living in this hell version of North Korea, that you've got, like, you know, South Korea is obviously an economic powerhouse. Samsung, you know, I'm going a blank on the car manufacturers, but, you know, they make and export a lot of things, a lot of wealth in that country.
Kia and Hyundai.
But a lot of, like, you know, it comes at a cost, all this economic prosperity. There are people who, you know, the father mentions this, like, if you have a driving position, a 500 college educated doctors, you know, postdocs will apply for it because Korea has for many generations prized higher education. Their schools are the most successful schools anywhere. The amount of college education that they have is, like, world class. But now, if every time McDonald's opens up a register, like, unless you have those college degrees, you're not going to get it. And there's 500 people trying to get that same slot. So it's like the pie keeps growing, but ever fewer people get ever larger slice of the pie. I mean, this is seems like it's almost a global thing at this point. Yeah. But there's a couple points where he kind of invites us and never makes a show of it. But, like, one of the Kim's mom apparently is a silver level Olympic athlete in hammer throw.
Yeah.
Something that
is some kind of decorated veteran, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know what his medal is for, but he has a medal for something.
Something
that,
like,
her medal?
I think it's, I don't know. You might be, cause, like, the son had 4 years of in the Korean Defense Force, which is why he understands English so much.
Okay.
Probably working side to shoulder with American soldiers on American bases. But I would believe, maybe I missed it. He's also a decorated war hero as well. But the thing is like that this family is not like without its pride and without its laurels. Yeah. Like, you know, these are things that like society would be like, oh, wow, that's really amazing. You achieved that thing, yet they're debased. And then you go to the parks and, you know, he's famous for being some kind of wealthy industrialist that allows him to live thousands of times better than the Kims. And is that really fair?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, the idea that this is happening sort of on a global scale now is something that really made that this movie resonate over here. Because, you know, it's one thing if we were, I don't know, Sweden or something, and you don't really have so many of these problems. It might not have resonated quite as much.
Yeah, I wonder if there is a country in the world that doesn't have any of this where, you know...
Probably not a country that doesn't have any of it, but certainly some more
countries,
than others.
Countries that do it better. But it does seem like the tale of the end of the 20th century and the early 21st century is an ever rapidly accelerating top class that is smaller and smaller and wealthier, and they just get... They're escaping... the gravitational pull of society at an ever faster rate. In fact, right before we recorded this, I was reading an article someone wrote about, you know, like I've read several of these stories, but essentially like there is a certain percentage of the super wealthy that are planning a post-civilization life, like island compounds, armed mercenaries, and this
New
one...
New Zealand.
Yeah, like do I live... You might have read the same article. Like they brought this futurist got hired... Or this technology advisor's professor got hired that he thought was going to give a keynote speech at some kind of investor retreat. But it turns out he was just propounded by these questions by like five or six wealthy people. And there are questions like, after the global climate collapses, would it be better to live in New Zealand or Alaska? What are ways you could maintain loyalty of like a private mercenary group if the dollar collapses? Is there any way we could like encode the food storage so we could use that as a leverage? It's just like fucking wild Mad Max type of questions being asked. And I don't know. It feels like to me this is something I've been waking up to. I feel like we got 30 to 50 years to kind of solve this, or like they'll be beyond us.
Oh, yeah. Automation is taking them way beyond us. And this is why I'm not... So this is probably off topic a little bit, but this is why I'm not super fond of like the UBI pitches that sort of index to like some sort of GDP, because, you know, a percentage of a thing can still be outscaled by a different percentage of a thing. So like you're talking about this runaway effect where... You know, the people at the bottom, okay, maybe they get a little bit more, but the people at the top are getting so much more that at some point they have no incentive to even keep the people at the bottom around.
Right.
And that's what I'm worried about. Like, you automate people out of jobs and stuff, and suddenly you're talking about, well, there isn't a driver position. There isn't a housekeeper position. There isn't... These positions don't even exist anymore. So, you know, whether you're the postdoctorate person who's 500th in line and can't get the job... doesn't fucking matter, because a job doesn't exist, period.
Right. Yeah. Grim stuff, man. And that's what this movie feels like, very grim. Like the final act is just a procession of ever spiraling madness and desperation. Because you now have this family, I forget their name, that the Kims have displaced, but they are literally like going to starve and die unless they fight back against the Kims. And the Kims are going to be right there, a year or two away from being right there in that same position. So they have to have this like desperate gladiatorial struggle to fight for their position. And then at the very end of the movie, that's when the flip of the understanding of the parasite turns around, because like they both of the heads of the households of the underclass warring for their scraps independently arrive at the idea that it's the parks that are the problem. The first guy, who's probably already a little insane, stabs Mama Park, and then there's some kind of thing that snaps inside Papa Kim, and he picks up the butcher knife and kills the park senior. And then you've got this wild denouement where the father's down there in the bunker hidden away and run for his life, and he's sending out these coded Morse code messages that he's hoping his son sees. Man, I
and his
so what's
son
your
does
I want
to see them and
yeah what's
he,
your interpretation of this
So my interpretation is that he's fucked. So the ending of this movie is really sad and hopeless, in my opinion. And it's kind of symbolized, I think, with that Scholar Rock, which he's been carrying this rock around. And as much as it symbolizes hope, which I think is what it's supposed to symbolize, he puts it down. He puts it back into a river at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of, I think, when he's envisioning like this future where he becomes this rich person, makes a whole bunch of money, buys the house out, and then his father is free, right?
Right.
This idea that he's going to somehow overcome all the obstacles in his path and become the kind of person who can free his family from the life of destitution they've been fated with.
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, like him dreaming about that is just that. It's a fantasy. It's never going to come true. And you can see it sort of with the final shot where he's just sitting on this couch in the same shit-filled house, moldy and probably killing him actively. And he's just looking into the camera, and the socks, the same socks that were hanging up in the beginning of the thing, are still hanging there. It's just, it's a return, essentially, to the status of at the beginning of this movie, which is very much one of despair.
Yeah, because I remember the first time I was watching this, like that, it was so affecting, like that birthday party massacre, and I was just still reeling from that, and it just kept on pile. And then like the way he shoots this is like him narrating a future success, and I had thought that like, is this some weird Korean thing where they'll do some kind of wild fantasy sequence that seems wildly unlikely? I'm like, I'm not buying any of this. There's no way this kid is going to go from rags to riches and buy this particular thing.
It's a kid who has no education, right?
Yeah.
He comes from a poor family, and he's brain damaged at this point. Like,
yeah. And I was thinking, like, is this some kind of, and I'm like, I'm not buying this. And I remember having that dissonance in my head, and it just snapshots from him welcoming his father out of the basement. You just do this snapshot. What do you call that? It's a crash edit. Smash cut. Yeah. You've got this situation where this kid is welcoming his father out from the basement. And as I'm grappling with, like, I don't know that I buy this, they just smash cut to him in that pitiable situation, is kind of 1,000-yard staring at the camera.
Yeah.
And oh my God, I felt like I couldn't get out of my seat for 5 minutes after I saw that, because it goes from this false hope that you know is false. And I think you're supposed to know that he knows is false.
Absolutely. Like, if you look at what his father is saying when they're in that shelter,
the no plan, yeah.
When he says, yeah, you don't make plans. Plans are hopeless. And he somehow is still clinging to this rock, which just seems to be following him. That's his hope. He puts it away. He's got nothing, and he's doing what his father told him not to do, which is to make a plan. And so when it snaps back to reality in that situation, you kind of understand he's committing a folly here. And I think that's, you know, even if the poor do everything right, even if they behave perfectly, they make all the good decisions in life, one small thing could just randomly destroy them. That's all it takes, one random act.
Yep.
And they're screwed for life. So,
and they contrast that with the Parks, who like are going on and on about how their camping trip was ruined. Oh, let's make lemons from lemonade by having all of our servants come and whip us a party together with a short notice.
Right.
And like the amount, like, I mean, that's the thing, like that I feel like is like the fundamental misunderstanding when people say that, like, you know, yeah, but I want a merit-based economy. I don't want, like, you know, all these social safety nets that stack the deck. And it's more of like, if you're born rich, you have to fuck up so long and so extensively, and you still have lifeline after lifeline after lifeline.
Yeah.
Whereas, as you said, if you're born in the working poor, you're one bad health crisis away. Like, I think about this all the time. My granddad didn't graduate high school, partially crippled entering the working workforce, and with one paycheck, put six kids through college and retired at 55. And I think about like what my family would be like if my granddad broke his back at age 30. Mm-hmm. And I also think about like what his family's turned into in the last 30 years. Like, it's a real kind of like rags to riches to rags story, because like most of my cousins aren't doing nearly as well as my aunts and uncles. And, you know, and they, a lot of them have college educations, but they're underemployed because they're just, you know, like in rural Indiana, there's not a lot of fucking work opportunities and they don't want to leave because that's where their family's at.
Global financial crises.
Like especially my younger cousins that got, you know, like I got a fairly established career before the first real, global recession hit. I feel that. I feel like my family is like the evidence of like that being true, that like, as you know, this meat grinder can do, like more and more of us being lost. Whereas if we were an old money family, yeah, you'd have a black sheep or two, but we, you know, my cousins would be founding companies and doing just riding on their generational wealth. Anyway, it's like I said, a very bleak film, but relentlessly watchable. And again, I saw some people talking about how this is a constantly evolving movie. Like when you're watching it, it's like such a screwball black comedy. Mm-hmm. And then like it turns into this like psychological thriller. It kind of does go into horror territory in the last act. Like the first time we see from the kid's perspective, that guy popping out of the basement, it's just vintage like Asian horror. Yeah. You know, this guy's crazy, right? Wide eyes, spotlighted, just coming out of the inky darkness. Him running around with his blood-covered face at the party, slashing people. Like, it constantly changes and changes until then it becomes this weird kind of tone poem in the last 5 minutes, a meditation on crushing poverty and how it destroys your dreams before they can even... Because I thought... That's what I thought is, like, he... You mentioned what his dad told him at the shelter, that he caught it. Like, I thought that smash cut to the end was almost him catching himself doing that. Yeah, I'm dreaming. It's leading me to form a plan. I can visualize it. You know what? Fuck it. That's not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right. And that's what I think separates this from something like Knives Out. Knives Out is more of a fun romp.
Yeah.
This has fun in it. And yeah. I love that dark comedy, but this has a very poignant message at the ending, mm-hmm. which I don't know. I think Knives Out has something to say about class and inequality, but not nearly as much as this film.
Yeah, man, I tell you what, I've rarely seen this is like almost Hitchcockian in how it ratchets up the tension in that like second to third act transition.
Yeah.
Using the fact that we already know what a fucking like a mess this house has been and what a complicated situation. And then the mom calls and says, I'm 8 minutes away, by the way, have this dumpling thing ready to go. Like and then the excruciating tension of the Kims being stuck under the couch and the table as the Parks start fucking. And, you know, like also it's like, I thought that was a little bit interesting how the Parks were universally condemning this young driver fucking in their BMWs, and oh, he probably has the type of girl that would leave her panties in there is probably on meth or cocaine, and yet that's the fantasy that they used when they were like fucking, when he's like, oh, put on those dirty panties, and she's like, yes, buy me drugs, like,
okay,
their
that's
fantasy,
where they were going with that. I was curious.
I thought that that's like, that's the illustration is like their like fun fantasy is like this lurid world that they look, you know, officially look down their nose at, but they're secretly enthralled at, gotcha. Enthralled by, because I don't, they're also doing like, I feel like I could watch this film a dozen more times and come away with something, because they're also doing something with the Kims rapidly feeling the ennui that the Parks are encased in, mm-hmm. just by spending an afternoon living like them. Like, oh, this is literally all there is.
Yeah.
No, you know, if we don't manufacture crisis with our children, and we don't, you know, throw a party like every day to distract yourself from how kind of utterly meaningless this existence is too, it just begs the question, like, why is any of this happening? Like, if no one is happy with the system, and some people are dying and living in squalor, why do we keep doing it? I don't know.
Good question.
I wonder, like, you know, you look and read history of, like, you know, what society felt about, like, as they're going through industrialization, what society felt like when they're going, you know, like, throwing off the last bits of the feudal society in the early 20th century for most of Europe. It's, like, it's interesting to see. It's filled with these transition periods of people like, well, you can't, there's no way you can live like this. We've lived this way for, you know, forever. And, you know, it's good and just and wise. And that seems so archaic. The idea that like, you got to have a king or queen, you got to have dukes and all this stuff. And they're just, you're better because they're born that way. And, it just seems so silly. And I wonder, like, 100 years from now, if we'll, you know, look back and see some of this, you know, late stage, early 20th century, 21st century paradoxes of life, if we'll see it as like equally foolish, or if there'll only be 100,000 people living on secure compounded islands. And the way the wild folk of the world lived is just a legend and myth. All right, well, that'll shut the books on Bong Joon-ho's Parasite. We are going to be looking at not a modern classic, but a classic. We're going all the way back to 1974 to consider the American mystery thriller, The Conversation, produced and directed by Francis Ford Coppola. He actually made and released this the same year as Godfather 2, and this movie was nominated for three additional Academy Awards, and he beat himself.
Good for him.
And it stars Gene Hackman as well as Godfather favorite John Cazale. That's Fredo, right?
Sure is.
And it has a lot of people. Harrison Ford's in this, Robert Duvall, Terry Garr, Cindy Williams. I don't know much about this film other than its reputation. I'm excited to see it. If you want to watch along with us, please do, because we'll have this out next Thursday. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you next week.